Welcome back to another episode of City Hall Pass. I'm Kapel Lungani, counsel to the mayor of New York City. We created this forum, the first of its kind in New York City, to give you, the public, a unique window into the highest levels of our city government. We interview New York City's finest public servants and get them to open up in a way that is both deeply personal and insightful. And on its best days, we hope that our podcast is equal parts educational and inspiring. And now I want to introduce my two co-hosts today, two brilliant women who inspire me every day, Best Chu and Kate Coughlin.
Thanks, Kapel. Happy to be here. This is Best Chu. I'm currently Chief of Staff to the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
Hi, I'm Kate Coughlin, and I currently serve as Deputy Counsel for the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
We are very excited to share with you part two of our conversation with NYPD's Deputy Commissioner of Intelligence and Counterterrorism, John Miller. John talked to us about his famous interview with Osama bin Laden, his memories of 9/11, his transition from journalism to public service, and much more. If you missed the first half of our conversation with John Miller, make sure to go back and check out part one. Thanks for listening to City Hall Pass, and we hope you enjoy.
You interviewed Osama bin Laden in 1998, 3 years before 9/11. We here in the United States think of him, rightfully so, as a terrorist who murdered thousands of innocent people. During your famous Nightline report, you talked about how UBL's soldiers viewed him as a god. What about him convinced hundreds, if not thousands, of people from all over the world to come to what were really arduous environments and place their lives at risk? What was it about this man?
So, and I want to be careful about my wording here so as not to be misconstrued, but it was leadership. And I say that because leadership is leadership. If it is for good, it's great. But if it's for evil, Adolf Hitler, you pick your despot of history. The qualities of leadership, the parts of leadership that work, can be used as strongly for evil as good. So bin Laden had leadership. The framing of your question is where the bullseye is, which is what made people come from their comfortable lives to live in arduous situations, sleeping in mountains and in caves and fighting against Russian armies? And the answer is he did. Remember, the bin Ladens in Saudi Arabia were a multi-billion dollar empire. This was Osama bin Laden from the bin Laden Empire who went to Afghanistan first to fight the Russians and then, frankly, went off in search of his next war. It was heady. He was drawn to it, maybe addicted, but he was looking for the next battle, and we became it. But when he traveled to a guest house, the men would clear out and find the best room in the guest house with the biggest bed, and they would say, you know, this is for you. And he would say, no, I'm going to sleep with my men on the floor. Leave that room for whosoever room that is. He managed by walking around. He would go through the camps and watch the training and talk to individuals, regardless of rank, meet with people. He would give the equivalent of sermons. Although he was not a religious scholar per se, he had a message and it resonated with so many. It was a David and Goliath story that he framed it as, despite the fact that, you know, he came from a wealthy family and brought lots of money to the fight. His approach was, on the face of it, humble. Which is really ironic, because if you peel back the psychology of bin Laden, the whole game was largely driven by ego. He wanted to be powerful. He wanted to be heard. He wanted to be famous. The proof of the pudding is he went to the Saudis when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and said, he'll run right across Kuwait onto our borders, and I will gather my mujahideen, and I will fight for the kingdom, and we will beat them back. And Prince Turki, who was the head of Saudi intelligence at the time, said, no, we're gonna do it with our people and the Americans and F-15s, but thank you very much for your loyalty. And that ultimately is what caused bin Laden to turn on him.
Yeah. So, John, I mean, you really hit on what I was going to follow up with here is you did not find, or it was readily apparent to you in meeting him, that the piousness, the devoutness was really an act. Because it seems to me, at least to his followers, they obviously bought it and thought it was authentic and thought he was a man of God. Here in America, certainly we think otherwise, but none of us have ever met him except for you. Was it readily apparent to you, or was he just a great actor?
I think he was a method actor. I believe he believed that he was pious. I believed he believed that his path was the path of the religion that he wrapped his message around. You can talk to any number of religious scholars who will tell you, no, it was not, but
During your interview with UBL, there was a point when he said that he felt all Americans, including the press, were fair game. I immediately, in my own mind, went back to an interview that Mike Wallace did with the Ayatollah Khomeini, where he had asked Khomeini about, or what he thought about people saying he was crazy. And had asked the translator to translate, and the translator said, "I'm not translating that."
Mike Wallace said, "You know, some people say that you're crazy." And then he stopped himself and said, "Their words, not mine." So I think he wanted to ensure that he was actually getting home from this interview.
Right. And it sort of made me think in that moment, if you felt some level of fear.
I had the same issue, which is, so it's May of 1998. Nothing has happened yet. Bin Laden is girding for some kind of war. He hasn't blown up the embassies. 9/11 isn't even a concept. And I am trying to break the ice in what is a tense situation because he's about to declare war on America. I'm an American. We need to sit and do this interview. So I say to the translator, because we had driven straight up the side of this mountain, there was nothing like a road. It was bone rattling through the dark of night. You know, they said, "This is Mr. Bin Laden, Mr. Miller." We, you know, introduced each other. And I said, "You know, tell him for a guy whose family is famous for being in the construction business, they could use a better driveway coming up this hill." And the translator looked at me, you know, appalled. And I remember saying, "Well, I guess we're not doing jokes tonight." But went on to ask him, "Did you finance the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1973? Did you plot to blow up airliners over the Pacific Ocean? Did you plot to kill the Pope in Manila? Did you have plans to assassinate President Clinton?" All the stuff that you always say to somebody when you first meet in their cave in a foreign country. He gave these long answers. And my fixer, the translator, in the back after, I said, "Did he answer any of the questions? Because they didn't translate the answers back." And he said, "We need to get the tapes. And we need to get out." And he synopsized, "I'm declaring war on the United States. This is not just against the people in the military uniforms, but civilians are also a target in this fatwa, this religious decree. I predict a black day for America, after which the United States will no longer be united. You know, we will win this war with you, as we did with our war against the Russians. And you will only understand this when you are dragging your bodies in the coffins and in the boxes in your shameful defeat," which sounded fairly ridiculous for a guy with a couple of thousand people in a few caves. On May 28th, 1998, it sounded less ridiculous on September 12th, 2001. And it became that exemplar of our ability, as the 9/11 Commission said, to fail in imagination, to underestimate adversaries, to fail to understand that in a new globalized society, the power of a non-state actor, not a country, not an army, not someone with a seat at the United Nations, could have devastating consequences if underestimated, which is what caused me to go really from one business into another.
Yeah, John, did you feel in that moment that there would come a day when the rest of America would know who this man was and not just the intel people? This wasn't going to be a one-off interview with somebody who just happens to be making some, what some considered outlandish claims from a cave in the middle of nowhere.
So I did. And I underestimated that too. We came back. We put the story together very carefully. It went on the air on July 10th, you know, a number of days after the interview. For many people, you know, you could have stopped 100 people on Broadway and said, "Hey, I'm going to interview Osama bin Laden." And 100 of them would have said, "I don't know who that is." So it was important to introduce this person to America because of the emerging threat that we estimated he represented and that the White House estimated he represented even then. I talked to Sandy Berger, the National Security Advisor, who said, "This is the single most dangerous non-state actor facing the United States now." So it was an important story, but it got very little reaction. And then on August 7th, 1998, simultaneously, two embassies were blown up, one in Nairobi, the other in Dar es Salaam. And Peter Jennings called from the anchor desk. I was fishing. It was August. It was off the coast of Montauk on a boat, and somehow the cell signal worked and the phone rang. Peter Jennings said, "What is the significance of East Africa that you would have two simultaneous attacks? What's going on with terrorism in Africa?" And I thought for one second and said, "It's not about East Africa." Remember the interview a month ago with the guy on the mountaintop in the cave with the fighters, Osama bin Laden? He declared war on America. The war just started. And that was a pivotal moment, I thought. It's when your crime story about a bombing in Lower Manhattan in the basement of the World Trade Center began to turn into what would become a global war.
Did U.S. intelligence services ever reach out to you before or after the UBL interview to talk about what we're talking about today?
You know, we asked the CIA for background on bin Laden, and they gave us a little historical perspective of where they thought he sat. Talked to the FBI about the World Trade Center investigation and whether he was going to be charged in that, because I thought it was very interesting if he's going to be charged with blowing up a building here in New York City to be able to get an interview with that person before that happened, because it might be harder after the fact. But we didn't coordinate with them in any particular way. What was interesting is after that, the bin Laden interview goes on, a worldwide travel alert goes out. It fades from memory because people are focused on President Clinton and the blue dress and all kinds of other things. You know, the following April, I got called by General Anthony Zinni of SOCOM, you know, to come down to Tampa. And he said, we'd really like to give you a tour of the base, show you the whole place. I thought, well, this will be an interesting learning experience. He said, and we'd also like you to give us a talk about, you know, the bin Laden interview. What did it mean? What did he say? So I give the presentation and then we get to Q&A. And, you know, a guy from way in the back says, how long after you returned were you debriefed by the CIA or the FBI or the Defense Intelligence Agency? And I remember pausing for a moment and said, you're the first people from the government that ever asked me to tell this story. What it suggests is that there was a pre-9/11 world and a post-9/11 world, and the synapses fired more slowly. People were more cautious about how maybe they engaged with the press. I don't know, but it would be different today.
And John, you actually were again called by the government very close to the time when the SEALs went in and actually killed bin Laden. Is that right?
So at the time, I was the Deputy Director for Intelligence Analysis at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. We had a range of functions about bringing together the intel analysis from all the 16 intelligence agencies, as well as blending that into the president's daily briefing. So I was used to kind of living in the daily drumbeat of the classified world. And I got a call from the CIA's bin Laden unit, and they said, we'd really like to hear the bin Laden story. And this is, you know, in the middle of the Obama administration. The bin Laden story happened in 1998. And I thought, well, sure, I know the story. You know, I have the slideshow. We'll bring the deck. I got in the room with the bin Laden unit and did an hour-long presentation on finding bin Laden, talking to bin Laden, the analysis of the messaging, why then, so on and so forth. They asked a lot of questions. It was not that different from many other presentations I'd done. At the end, somebody said, that footage of him walking around with that slight limp, do you have any more of that that wasn't used? Are there any outtakes? And I said, I can look. And, you know, well, if there's any extra, you know, I can get it. And I walked out with my aide-de-camp, who was an extraordinarily good intelligence officer, a top-notch spy. He had been the guy who engineered the capture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11. Nobody knew to this business. And we're walking down this big, empty hallway, you know, where the polish on the floor is so much you can see your face in it and you can hear the echo of your steps. And I turned to him and I said, why would they want old footage of bin Laden walking around? And he looked at me and he says, well, I guess they have somebody walking around. And then about 3 weeks later, you know, they had the guy they called the pacer who kept walking back and forth in the garden under the grape arbor there, that they wanted to know, like, that gait, that walk, that slight limp, is that bin Laden in that compound in a place called Abbottabad? They had it right.
I think we all remember that night when President Obama came on TV and told us that Osama bin Laden was dead. What were your feelings that night?
Well, the phone rang and they said, this thing that, you know, we've talked about has happened. My first thought was, we're going to have to redo the entire presidential daily briefing for tomorrow. And then my second thought is, no, the president was probably there for this whole thing. And there's very little to brief him on, except what will the new shape of Al-Qaeda be after bin Laden? But there was a great kind of exhaling on the emotional side, not the business side. I was home and I had been at the Washington Correspondents' Dinner the night before, watching the president act normal, even though that was the original date for the hit, and it was shifted a day for weather. And I went into the kitchen, and I thought, well, there's going to be this press conference at 10:30, so I'll watch it. but I grabbed a beer from the refrigerator. And then I thought, this is more than a beer thing. So I got a bottle of Jack Daniels, and I was going to pour a glass. And I said, don't go back and forth from the porch. Just take it with you. So I brought the beer and the Jack Daniels out with the laptop so I could watch the thing. And I picked up a cigar from the cigar box in the den. And I thought, let me just go out and kind of live this moment when this thing is over. The thing isn't over, but this chapter of the story is over now. And I thought, you know, we're not the terrorists. We don't celebrate the death of another human being, no matter what the circumstances. And then I thought again, and I'm like, you know what? The hell with him. We're going to have a good time on the porch. We're going to have beers and cigars, and we're going to drink Jack Daniels, and we'll watch the president on the television. And I saw the press conference, and then I flipped around from CNN to Al Jazeera to different stations watching the coverage. And they were talking about his meaning in history, bin Laden's, the pivotal moment that we were in at that moment, the other pivotal moment of 9/11, the road in between them. And as I was looking at the footage, I realized that's him sitting against that map in that green jacket with his gun leaning against the wall. And the person sitting opposite him that's not in that frame was me. And I thought for a moment about my position in those moments of history and felt lucky that that chapter had closed and that I had had a part of it on both ends.
In 1998, you know, you interview Osama bin Laden. You get a call after the East Africa bombings, and it sounded like you, you know, immediately knew this is Osama bin Laden. On September 11th, did you know it was Osama bin Laden?
I thought it was Osama bin Laden, but those who do not study history are doomed to repeat it. And those who study journalism in crisis know that they don't study history. So I recalled that in the Oklahoma City bombing, the best experts in terrorism all ran on television and said, this is Hezbollah. This is an attack from the Middle East. You know, it spurred anti-Muslim sentiments right away. And it turned out to be regular old Americans, you know, an army veteran and his friend. So I was very cautious. When the second plane hit, I said, okay, this is a different level of capability. And this is very likely to be Osama bin Laden. And the choice of targets speaks to Al-Qaeda. I didn't want to be the first one to have that out of my mouth, even though it was the obvious choice. As time went on, it just became more apparent. And Peter Jennings said, when did you do that bin Laden interview? And I said, oh, it was 5 years ago. He said, well, where is it? And I said, there's a transcript in the computer. And he sent a kid to say, get the transcript. Peter Jennings was one of the fastest, smartest, get-to-the-point guys you'll ever see on live television. And he took that transcript. It was 7 pages, single-spaced. He had a highlighter. Some video was on, and he highlighted this page here, another paragraph down here. He flipped the page, 2 lines here, 3 lines there. He handed it back to the kid, and he said, have someone pull these sound bites. And he played them. I predict a black day for America. And that was that day. It was everything that you thought wouldn't happen, couldn't happen. And it had happened.
Yeah, I remember I was in college at the time, and my dad worked at the World Trade Center. He was fine. But yeah, my dad worked there. My uncle worked there. You know, I remember waking up to the radio, and they were like, this is not a joke. They're like, this is what just happened. I was in Boston. And I remember like that night hearing the F-15s flying out of, I guess, somewhere in Boston to New York. That weekend, my parents drove up. They like just came up to spend time with me. They brought me the New York Times. We still have it. And like, as a New Yorker, it's like, even today, it's just very, it's very emotional.
I mean, there are these generational markers. If you're 65, you know, it's where were you when Kennedy was killed? Where were you on the night the lights went out in New York City? Where were you when Martin Luther King was killed? Do you remember, you know, being woken up for school when they said Bobby Kennedy was dead? And there's a whole generation for whom that question is simply, where were you on 9/11? And all those other questions are very much faded. That is kind of the marker of our generation in moments in history where everybody, and it doesn't matter if you were in New York or you were in LA or you were in Oklahoma, everybody knows where they were, how they heard, what they thought, what they did. And the what they did story is really interesting. Some of them, like those after Pearl Harbor, ran out and signed up, put me in the fight. Others who were in college said, I'm going to finish and become an intelligence analyst for the government instead of for J.P. Morgan Chase. Yet others were little kids in school, took that in some kind of stride, and have grown up in a world where they never knew, still don't know, what we knew, which was the innocence of a time when things like that were inconceivable.
So at some point in your career, you switched paths from reporting to law enforcement. And it had to be rather a shock to the system, at least in my mind, to go from being a reporter and being a journalist to being someone in law enforcement and to have to earn the respect of law enforcement officers as a reporter. Why did you make that transition?
Well, the first time it was almost natural. I'd gone from being a crime reporter in New York City to being the deputy commissioner for public information, where you deal with the reporters for the police department. The shock to the system there was you'd gone from being on one side of the yellow tape to being on the other. You know, I remember thinking, wow, I've had my nose pressed up against this glass most of my life, and now, you know, I'm going to be in the middle of it. And the first thing you learn on the other side of the yellow tape is the people on the opposite side probably know everything you know, but maybe more. And if you get it wrong, you're going to be in trouble. So it's a shock to the system that way. The second time was a little bit different. After being deputy commissioner for public information, I went back to journalism, and that was with Commissioner Bratton. We stayed friends all that time. And I went from the years of covering the mafia to the years of covering terrorism and understanding that. And then 9/11 happened. I was deeply affected by 9/11. I lost so many people that I knew well. And I felt that I had been just on the edge of that story with the Bin Laden interview and other stories saying something bad is about to happen. And I am in no way suggesting I knew the what or the where of that, or that, you know, nobody listened to me. But I was part of the warning process there that failed, even as a journalist. So after 9/11, it was a short time later, in the middle of covering the Washington sniper story, the phone rang and Bratton said, "Hey, I've just been appointed chief of police of Los Angeles. And, you know, I want to talk about going out there." And we had breakfast, and he said, "I want you to be head of counterterrorism and intelligence," which was a big shift from being the guy who dealt with the media for the police department. And I said, "You know, you're going to get a backlash on that. Some reporter from New York in such a sensitive job." And he said, "I have 9,200 cops who know how to be the LAPD and a couple of hundred of them in counterterrorism. But I don't have one who understands the thinking of Al-Qaeda from the inside, the global nature of the threat, who's been there and studied it for years. That's what you bring to it." So I thought about it for 3 seconds and said yes, and went from the LAPD to the FBI to the Director of National Intelligence. And the one thing you figure out is that journalism and intel is the same thing. You've got to get the information first, you've got to get the information right, then you have to figure out what does it really mean and who needs to know it. The transition from actually journalism to intelligence was pretty natural.
So you were appointed to the Deputy Commissioner for Intelligence and Counterterrorism in 2014 by Commissioner Bratton. What does the head of intelligence and counterterrorism do?
The head of intelligence and counterterrorism worries. You worry about everything. You worry about, is there an attack being planned against New York City? If there is, do we know about it? If we know about it, do we have the controlling features to make sure it's not going to happen and that we can prosecute somebody and disrupt it? You're worried about the criminal side, which is where are the guns coming from? How do we stop them from coming in? Who are the crews that are fighting with other crews out there in the street? How do we reduce that violence? And you go to bed every night thinking about what was it that we didn't think of? So you are in the prevention business. So what's intelligence about? Intelligence is about understanding a problem, and analysis is about understanding the problem enough to affect it in the way you want to. So in the Intelligence Bureau, we're all about intelligence, analysis, prevention. In the Counterterrorism Bureau, we shift over to training, equipment, response, preparedness. So counterterrorism assumes we have to be ready to respond to it if it happens. Intelligence assumes that we have to prevent it if we know about it. And you meld those two together and you have a package that can protect a place like New York City.
I understand that you, like me, both love New York City and love food. So if you were giving a family member or a loved one a tour of New York City, where would you take them for breakfast, lunch, dinner?
Breakfast would be crepes on Columbus, because finding a good, credible crepe, sweet or savory, is not just like, oh, there's a crepe place, let's stop by. It requires testing all the crepe places. That's where I would start for breakfast. And you can go either way there. It can have ice cream and honey and, you know, brown sugar in it, or it can have eggs and asparagus and hollandaise sauce, but crepes are the way to go. For lunch, I would go to J.G. Mellon's. And there's arguments about this. I get it. But for my money, is the best hamburger in New York City. A lot of people get their hamburgers mixed up about what the hamburger is about, which is about, oh, their bacon cheeseburger pizza burger with pineapple is great. It's like, you got to get to the core, which is what's the actual burger like before you start putting stuff on it. And that's the top to me. And for dinner, it would be Campagnola, which is also 74th and 1st. So you could actually walk there from lunch at Mellon's, as Italian restaurants go. And there are so many good Italian restaurants. There's Come Prima on Madison Avenue, Campagnola. But if I had to pick one, it would be one of those two. And the thing about Campagnola or Come Prima is they'll give you the menu and you just hand it back to them. And you say, this is what I want. I would like to have an antipasto salad with this, that, and the other thing, or the red peppers and anchovies and something. And then I would like to have a combination of veal and shrimp franchise with some sauteed spinach on the side, and make sure that the last piece of Napoleon doesn't get eaten before we get around to it. Oh, and maybe a double espresso and a little Sambuca. And I think I have a cigar in the car. This night's going to all work out.
Did you hear that?
It was an echo of Miller?
You know, I've been hearing people say that a lot recently, but as someone in the intelligence, you must have heard a lot about the rumor Miller. You know what else I've been hearing about the rumor Miller? It's a new game where we give you two options and you pick one.
Okay, Kate, I'm ready.
Emmy or Peabody?
Emmy.
LAPD or NYPD?
NYPD.
Journalism or law enforcement?
I'm going to say law enforcement.
Seersucker or Navy suit?
Navy.
Okay, one more question, but I think we know the answer. Elaine's or Campagnola?
Both. Campagnola first, and then Elaine's.
And stay tuned for more on the
John, you have been incredibly kind to us, and we want to thank you so much for joining us today. I think it's an understatement to say your life is truly one for the books. John, thank you for your extraordinary service to New York City, and thank you for taking time out of your extremely busy schedule to share your life story with us.
Well, Kapel, Beth, Kate, thanks for allowing me to drone on, but it was fun talking to all of you.
I want to thank NYPD's Deputy Commissioner of Intelligence and Counterterrorism, John Miller, for sitting down with us and sharing some truly unique stories from his fascinating career. We hope you enjoyed this conversation and look forward to talking to you soon on another episode of City Hall Pass.